Welcome to This Week in Private Markets, a podcast by TAP. We give investors, allocators, advisors, and others a weekly digest that keeps you in the know about the news in private markets. Please see the show notes for relevant disclaimers. This is the week of November 13th, and this is what we at TAP saw in private markets. A lot of big deals again this week. We'll power through them real quick here. Blackstone gets $8 billion for its direct lending fund. Coatue raised $1.4 billion, but it had to cut its fees to do so. PAI Partners raised over $7 billion for buyouts. Coastal Ventures raised $3 billion. And L Squared Capital Partners raised $840 million. So a lot of stuff going on there. Now, for the first main story today, let's move over to Asia and China specifically. Private equity firms have accumulated $1.5 trillion worth of assets in China over the past two decades, and now they're struggling to exit them. Of course, they're counting on these returns, but with trouble in China and concerns about Xi Jinping's policies, the market is now demanding heavy discounts for these assets, 30 to 60%. Which compares to, you know, typical discounts of 15% over in Europe and the US. Some firms are trying to set up continuation funds, but it's all turning out to be much more difficult than they imagine. And on top of that, not only is the exit environment difficult, but fundraising is also difficult for Asia-focused funds. So Carlyle, for example, this week had to cut its Asia fundraising target by 30%. What do you guys make of all this?
Not only that, but I think I was seeing the other day, they're also allocating much less to China out of that. So they had a bigger piece in their prior funds in that Asia fund that Carlyle had that was allocated towards China. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like there's a very big cooling effect going on in regards to, you know, investing in China and in the private markets for sure. You know, I think they were saying that in, you know, 2021, there was $299 billion, so almost $300 billion raised for these Asia focused funds. And, you know, in 2022, that fell to $154 billion. And then this year so far, it's been only $73 billion. So, so obviously pretty far off of those numbers, probably going to be down 50% plus for the year. So yeah, like you said, very challenged. And it's partially because of the slowdown, but it's also in specifically in Asia because of the sort of geopolitics of the situation there.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of this, I think, is also, you know, being let down after very high expectations. You know, I think, you know, China's not a 8-9, you know, even some years 10%, you know, growing GDP per year. You know, it's probably more of a, you know, 4 or 5% growing economy, you know, if you believe the official government, you know, statistics. So obviously, that's still very, very impressive. I mean, I think, you know, the United States and Western Europe would love to be growing consistently at kind of 4 or 5%. But, you know, I think the other point here is, you know, finally, these kind of large structural imbalances in the Chinese economy have, you know, come to bear. I think there have been certain economists, certain investors who over the last, you know, decade or two have been signaling, you know, towards the serious issues right around
over a decade of signaling, multiple decades. Yeah, I mean, people have been talking about the Chinese, you know, housing and real estate sector going to implode for, you know, 20 years now, and people are still talking about it. I mean, I just do have a hard time believing that, you know, that's going to happen, but definitely agreed about the slowdown for sure.
Well, that's what you can do if, you know, if you've got a nation of, you know, 1.4 billion people, you can just kind of keep building apartment blocks to nowhere and bridges to nowhere, you know, over a decade or two. But, you know, perhaps they've sort of exhausted that stimulus for their economy at this point, you know, in the last year or two. And you know, sort of the impact of, you know, the COVID restrictions, you know, probably made that more apparent. And then you do obviously also see these large imbalances or these large structural challenges in their demography. You know, obviously very, very high levels of youth unemployment, you know, signaling that the economy, frankly, is just not generating enough jobs, you know, for how large, you know, of the population it is. For how large a population it is, excuse me. And then at the same time, right, population growth has slowed. I mean, the population is actually decreasing. So, you know, working age population is leaving the economy, and that's obviously going to impact growth and productivity. So, you know, you do see these mega trends, it seems, finally putting you know, an end to this massive, massive growth engine that we've seen over the last, 40 years.
Yeah. I mean, the youth unemployment, I mean, I think it's 16 to 22, somewhere in that range. They've jumped from 10% to 20%. Like you said, their population has shrunk for the first time since we've been tracking this stuff for many, many decades. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously it's difficult, but I think there are more acute issues as well this year, right? Because everything we say there could have said in prior years. And there, I think the geopolitical underlay behind all this is one of the things that's really causing the shrinking up of this. And it's the reason that you see all these firms that Thomas talked about, this $1.5 trillion that's over there that folks are, potentially wanting to get liquidity out of and not able to, is because there is sort of this separation. And I think, one reason it's interesting to talk about this week is because she is over here in San Francisco, where I'm based out of, meeting with Biden. And it was just interesting to hear, a lot of, words that were just very friendly between the two of them. And hopefully more of that can happen so that we can, continue having a great trading and investment relationship between the U.S. and China.
But what's the conclusion here? Diamond hands and your value will come back, or you should have exited earlier if you want to get liquidity for your China issue? Earlier.
I mean, I think the demography and the overall stats sort of show what it is. I mean, I think for a while they had this 6% target that they were, maintaining at all costs in their numbers. COVID allowed them to break that because, of course, extenuating circumstances. And now maybe we're getting more real numbers, but regardless, the numbers are much, much lower. And it's not looking like they're going to be as much of a behemoth as they were a few years ago. It seems like they're going to be what they are, which is a really thriving and an incredibly large, superpower. It does seem like the S curve is hitting its diminishing returns point.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think we're definitely approaching a decade now, a 10 years look forward period where there's just going to be much, much slower growth, I think, than we're accustomed to. I mean, I think, the sort of median an analyst look on Chinese growth through, the next 20 years, nearly the next 20 years through 2045 is, an economy that actually ends up growing less than 1% annually. I think there certainly is a view among at least, quote unquote, the smartest guys in the room that, the economy is going to slow down substantially. That doesn't take away from the fact that, it will be, the second largest, if not largest economy, right, over the next 20, 30 years. But it's certainly not going to replicate, the growth engine that, really powered much of the global growth here since the 1980s.
Very good. Let's move on to the next topic. Blackstone is raising $400 million through a collateralized loan obligation secured by the loans held by its $52 billion private credit fund. And they're raising these $400 million to basically boost their own lending power. And the AAA tranche of this CLO is expected to price at a yield that is roughly 2.3 percentage points above the current floating interest rate benchmark. Adam, you're our in-house credit guy.
Yeah, Adam, could you explain just how something like this works generally, just for folks who don't know? I mean, it's what a CLO kind of is.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, a CLO is, sort of at a high level in theory, a way to mix a whole bunch of different assets, in this case, loans, and sort of split up those assets into different, tranches. So that you can get an overall cheaper rate, right, for the debt that you're borrowing, right, an overall cheaper cost of capital. Effectively, what happens is you take a bunch of assets. Here, they're taking a bunch of the Blackstone Credit Fund loans. They're basically taking the best ones, kind of the middle ones and the worst ones, and they're putting them, into different tranches, kind of from the best rated to the worst rated. Obviously those AAA rated ones are at the top. Those are the loans backed by the best companies, most, least likely to default, least likely to have a missed interest payment. Hence, you know, the relatively small spread of, you know, two and a half points above, you know, the benchmark rate. But then you kind of work your way down the stack of credit quality into the second and third and fourth, et cetera, tranches. And you know, you obviously get much higher spreads because you get much worse asset quality, right? Loans backed by much worse companies, maybe distressed companies. And then, of course, you've got the equity portion of a CLO, which, you know, Blackstone here itself, I believe, is holding. And that's really the residual value. So, I mean, typically, right, if you run the math on these CLOs, the blended rate of the whole vehicle tends to be a bit lower than if you went and just got a bank loan, for example. So, I mean, that's sort of the logic behind it. And investors can, you know, pick and choose which tranche they want to buy. You know, those buying, you know, the AAA having a different risk profile than those obviously buying, you know, the second, third and fourth tranches, you know, or whatever it may be. So, I mean, this is not new, you know, financial engineering. This has been around for a very long time, for decades. Typically, though, what's new here, though, is, you know, this is being done now by a very, very large private credit manager. Historically, these CLOs have sort of been stuffed full of, you know, loans in the publicly traded, you know, syndicated loan or leveraged loan market, where, you know, there is pretty good public reporting. There's a lot of analyst coverage. You can check bond prices or loan prices, you know, on publicly available sources. And that is a, you know, multi-trillion dollar market in and of itself. This, you know, is new because this is obviously private debt. You know, you have to sign an NDA to even get sort of the underlying loan and underlying asset information to even understand really what's going on in these loans. And, you know, I think the last point here is this is just being done at a massive scale. CLOs with private loans have been done historically in middle market companies, or sort of in the middle market space, not in a, you know, with respect to a $52 billion credit fund. So, you know, again, we've talked a lot about private equity, commingling different business lines, insurance and private credit. We've talked a lot about them perhaps being systemically important financial institutions and posing systemic risk to the economy. Again, I think this offers, you know, firepower to those arguments that they are becoming a bit too intertwined, a bit too complex, difficult to understand, and perhaps posing systemic risk. But anyway, I'll stop the soliloquy here. And,
it's a $400 million CLO they're doing. It's a $52 billion portfolio. Now, I assume that it's probably a subset of the loans they've actually put in there.
Not the whole it's portfolio. Unclear what it's collateralized, you know, by. But again, right, small amount on a big credit fund. But I suspect we're going to see a lot more of these, you know, and these are going to be adding up. And it's not just Blackstone, you know, it's Ares and other types of, you know, private equity plus credit managers.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just they, like you said, you need NDA to even see anything about these things. So it's just tremendous opacity to them to coming into this. And so obviously at these levels, of course, I'm sure it's some of their more secure things, but you can imagine that if you scale this up to where every private credit fund's doing it, where it's a large, they're refinancing large portions of their portfolio using these types of instruments, that it would be troublesome. But you know, everything is good in the right proportion, and bad when it's overdone. So you know, I don't think any cause for alarm here. But like you said, you know, it's definitely there's a door opened now that that is maybe interesting to look at.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is a trend to watch, you know, and I'm sure we'll be watching it unfold over the coming months.
Good stuff. Let's move on. Global private equity and VC investment is continuing to sink. So the aggregate transaction value is now down 36% from the same month a year ago. This is for October. Transactions are also down for the period, down from 1,240 to just a little over 900. This is all kind of a familiar story at this point, right? The cost of capital has gone up. There's a little bit of a bid-ask spread as far as exit opportunities go. But, you know, people now seem confident that the Fed is done hiking. Over the past couple of weeks, the stock market has been doing very well on that news. And, you know, people generally say the market is forward-looking. So do we feel like this is the end of the downward trend, or is it going to continue into the abyss?
continue. That's my call on this one. I think, you know, the reason that public markets have rallied is the concept of a soft landing, seeming highly probable. That does not mean that, that actually, in fact, does mean that rates are going to be higher for longer, which is how you've seen bonds respond as well. And so soft landing means that there won't be any reason for them to cut rates, which means they're going to keep rates this high for a long time, which makes it difficult to get the financing to do the typical type of transactions and get the prices that you need to overcome that bid-ask spread and all those things that people talk about. So I think we're still in the middle of this, this, you know, new rate environment that is different than the past, than the 10 years prior to 2021.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to disagree with that. You know, inflation is obviously has stabilized and does continue to tick down. It is still above the 2% target of the Fed. I think it was, 3.2%, you know, last month in terms of the core inflation measures that the Fed really cares about. So, yeah, look, and we haven't sort of eliminated any, in fact, this has only increased. I mean, the sort of geopolitical shock potential that's out there. There's obviously, conflicts in Eastern Europe, conflicts in the Middle East, that can continue to impact supply chain, commodity prices, right? I mean, the one thing the Fed simply cannot control, right, is the price of oil and gas. So, I mean, you know, if that continues to be volatile, and that continues to eat, into, sort of the paychecks of citizens throughout the globe. I mean, right, that will continue to have, pressure on the economy, that will continue to create inflationary pressures that are sort of out of the control of the government. And, I don't necessarily think we've escaped this, recession versus soft landing question just yet, given, the global economy does seem to be skating on thin ice. Things are obviously better. I don't think, private equity, owned company executives or investors in private equity funds should be thinking that, maybe in 1 to 2 quarters, this starts to roll off. I mean, I tend to think, this is going to be at least another year or so of kind of understanding where the trends are. And, I don't think we're near kind of the end here at all, in my view, either.
Agreement all around. Very good. And let's leave that there. Up next, we move to salary and payment for professionals working in private equity. Now, just to set the stage here, private equity has the benefit of, pulling salaries out of management fees, which are much more stable than, the type of revenue that you might see in investment banking or hedge funds, which have a little bit more of that feast or famine dynamic. So with that being said, private equity investment professionals expect their total cash comp to be 13% higher this year over last year. And on top of that, a number of firms are doing things like contractually guaranteed bonuses, and also a number of non-cash benefits and perks like an additional day off here or there, gym discounts, travel insurance, student loan repayments, car insurance assistance we also saw. So just a ton of stuff. Quite generous.
Well, man, I mean, thank God the private equity professionals are getting paid. I've looked into some of the reporting, and I think it's done by Odyssey and maybe Bloomberg did some number crunching as well. But certainly the headhunters have. I mean, some of these stats are kind of hysterical, right? I mean, I think I read something that, employee personal time off has increased by 2 days in the past 2 years. And I think vacations have increased by 1.5 days in the last 2 years. I mean, these are like rounding errors.
Adam, deal making is down, there's not as much to do.
Deal making is down so much that, you would expect my vacation time to increase by a commensurate level, but clearly it's not. It's increasing by another 24 hours or 48 hours. I think private equity firms are struggling to raise money. They're obviously struggling to offload assets or to sell assets, that they've financed in their buyouts. And they're probably, looking to preserve, kind of some of their top talent. A lot of these increased benefits and salaries are, I think, largely going to, middle level professionals at these funds. Right. And, much less going to junior level professionals and, and senior level professionals. So I think they are certainly trying to preserve the happiness of kind of the future generation here. I would note a lot of this increase in quote unquote compensation is coming from performance shares. So look, I mean, I'd much rather have, you know, cash today in exchange for a carry that, you know, who knows if I'm even going to be here or, you know, if it'll ever materialize. But I think, you know, firms are doing what they can to sort of optically and also in real ways, I think, keep people happy in these difficult times. But I mean, look, at the end of the day, I don't know if there's much to this story other than, you know, private equity is kind of dealing with probably questions they haven't dealt with, you know, in a decade due to kind of the changing macro environment here.
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, no one was ever thinking that they would do anything besides grow. I mean, I think in general, maintaining the kind of morale through this difficult time is important and probably well worth the cost of just, you know, keeping the low level, mid level people, you know, continuing their salary raising at a moderate pace. The thing that, of course, has fallen off a cliff is, you know, all the carry checks and everything. The, with exits down so much, no one's getting any carry checks. And so, you know, a lot of the, you know, I think this masks that the actual compensation industry, which goes to the top layer, does exhibit this feast and famine that you talked about, Thomas, in investment banking and hedge funds, in that the top investors and general partners of these firms are going to make drastically less these years than they would in the feasting years.
Yeah, we should point out that I think Stephen Schwarzman made over $1 billion last year. So
in 2021, he himself, yes.
Apologies. In 2021, a single individual at Blackstone made over $1 billion. I mean, look, I know he's the head of the firm, but let's not pity the private equity professional too much. They probably did very, very well in the years leading up to 2021 and, you know, might have to wait a little bit more for their carry checks to kick in here. But you know, their wealth is certainly not going anywhere. It's not evaporating overnight.
Look, I think the mix of management fees and carry is very effective at allowing you to have the guaranteed compensation to weather a storm like this, but the motivation to, you know, swing for the fences and make great investments, like the combination of the two works quite well.
Very good. Let's move on to our last story for today. CalPERS is announcing a $100 billion net zero pledge and some new climate accountability measures. Basically, moving forward, the fund's portfolio is going to target net zero, meaning that carbon emissions from investments are evenly balanced with carbon reductions from investments. And they're putting $100 billion towards this. And towards climate solutions, and they want to do that by 2030. And that also, of course, entails that they want to sell investments that don't kind of fit into this new strategy.
$100 billion always strikes me as one of those things that's like $100 billion over some time period. You know, it's like over a decade. Like, you can make an announcement like this, and, you know, CalPERS, I think, is on the CIO hunt right now. Like, you make an announcement like this, I mean, like 8 years from now, like where are you in the $100 billion? Much been like, it's a huge number. I think it's an increase of $53 billion from where they had it set before or something. But it's just kind of like a big number to throw around at this problem. So yeah, I don't. I mean, obviously, it's them taking a big look at this.
Yeah, becoming net neutral. I think that's a very different question than, you know, actually just, becoming carbon free. Right. So I suppose, you know, they're investing in, enterprises that will yield that do not produce carbon, and that earns you a credit. And that's what you offset a carbon producing investment with. I mean, it's not entirely clear to me, how this even works, to be honest, generally speaking, or even in this context.
It seems like it'd be incredibly difficult to track. And I know that there is a lot of solutions right now being built around like how to track the sort of the carbon footprint of, and in general ESG things around these private equity businesses. But obviously, you know, with the opacity, like, it is very difficult to track these things and try and figure out like how much carbon is my investment in this company producing versus another one that maybe is taking carbon out. And CalPERS is involved in so much of the economy that has investments that span so much of the economy. This seems like an insanely impossible task to do. And yeah. so really maybe this press release may be most of what ends up actually having an impact here.
Right. I mean, the accounting of this seems hard. I mean, what is, you know, do the investors in TAP, I mean, what are we crediting them with? Are we carbon neutral? Are we, I mean, what do we, you know, what do we do? Right. I mean, I don't know. The accounting of this just seems like a mess. And all that is to say is it, you know, I'm skeptical. And you know, is this a little bit of greenwashing or something like that? I mean, I don't know. I think this is, you know, great. I suppose they're not going to invest another $53 billion in fossil fuels. But you know, where that $53 billion goes to actually solving the climate problem, you know, proactively, you know, that I'm highly skeptical of.
Well, they can invest $50 billion into carbon emitting stuff as long as they invest $50 billion into carbon reducing stuff. So it all has to balance out at the end.
That's one way of doing the carbon accounting there.
Excellent.
Yeah, reducing stuff. I don't know. It doesn't seem very scientific to me, but I guess we'll see.
There's an art and a science to it. Let's wrap up here. Been another great episode of This Week in Private Markets, and we'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.